This is the Creative Agency Podcast,
where we explore the strategies,
aspirations, methods, and mistakes
behind growing and maintaining
a successful
creative agency.
Hello out there. Happy holidays. I've sequestered myself once again in my two-year-old's bedroom to bring you this brief intro. We've actually got a house full of kids and at least one barking dog, so there may be a little ambient audio to add character to this. So, the Creative Agency podcast is almost 1 year old, if you can believe that. This will be my last episode of the year, but don't worry, I've already got some really cool interviews lined up for next year. I know you're all dying to find out if my agency, Murmur Creative, hit our 2016 goal of $1 million in revenue, so we'll be doing that episode in January. I won't let the cat out of the bag yet, so stay tuned. Today's interview is with Peck Pong Pat of Impeccable, a Silicon Valley-based creative agency that specializes in UI, UX design, and development. You know, you hear a lot about agency owners that get seduced by the world of startups and throw their hat into the ring. Peck actually started by co-founding a startup and then moved on to start his own agency. Anyway, I think you'll really like this interview. We're going to talk about how Peck grew his agency and talk about the importance and strategy behind UI UX design, how it relates to the web, mobile apps, and more. Stay tuned for Peck's takeaways at the end of the show, and be sure to check out impeccable.com. That's impeccable.com to learn more about Peck's agency. If you like the show, please submit a review in iTunes. If you have any questions or suggestions, hit me up at creativeagencypodcast.com, and let's get to it. All right, well, I am here with Peck Pong Pat of Impeccable, a UI UX focused agency located in the Bay Area. Welcome to the show, Peck.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
So your agency, how long has it been around?
Started it in late 2011, early 2012, so about 5 years.
Nice. And what made you want to start your own agency?
You know, I kind of fell into it. I had moved to the Bay Area from Chicago to start a company. And, you know, like a legitimate Silicon Valley startup, high-tech startup, and me and my co-founder dabbled on a bunch of ideas. You know, it was very frustrating. We'd build stuff and wouldn't get traction. We'd build stuff, wouldn't get traction. So after about a year of that, we decided to amicably split and part ways to go on and do, you know, our own things. And I ended up kind of leaning back onto what was producing revenue, which was services. It's being essentially a mercenary and being hired guns to help design and develop product. So my background is both engineering and design. So I could design something and then kind of bring it to life and code the front end and do some integration to the, you know, the back end or an existing product. So that's how I started and just kept doing that until I took on more work than I could handle. And you know, at one point I had three clients who they couldn't have me full time. So they would hire me, you know, maybe like make me work like 12-hour days because they each wanted me as much as possible. And I did that for about 3 months and I was probably gonna fall over and die if I didn't do anything to change that. So I brought in a part-time person to help me. I hired, you know, someone else. And that worked out really well. It helped me free up my time and we were more productive. By the end of the first year, we ended up having two people help me. So by the first year, we had two employees. Yeah.
Wow. And then you grew pretty quickly after that, right? How many employees do you have now?
In total, we have 30 people, which is a mix of both employees and contractors.
Wow. So when did most of that hiring happen?
No, it was all gradual. This is a bootstrap services company. So we grew based on need. We grew organically as accounts grew. So there was no huge growth spurt per se. You know, when we grew an account or had in more work than we could all collectively do, then we'd increase our staff. You know, we'd interview people, see if there's a good fit. If we saw that an account was had a chance to be more ongoing, more permanent, then rather than being a contract for hire, it'd be more, we would look for a more full-time role.
Makes sense. That's kind of how we do it around here too.
Yeah, yeah.
So is your background in coding?
I have a degree in computer engineering, which at the time was basically, you know, half electrical engineering, half computer science. And then for the first about 7 years, during the .NET era, Visual Basic, C++. That was when I graduated, and that was kind of the stack that I was working in, ASP.NET. I graduated right during the first internet boom.
Gotcha.
So that kind of dates me a little bit, but yeah, so that was my background. I did software development, web-based, Microsoft stack for about 7 years. And then this kind of around that time that coincided with the reemergence of Apple as a company. You know, Steve Jobs had come back and he had started putting out these great products. And I felt like, you know, I really wanted to be in front in terms of the product rather than in the back coding, you know, the back end. I felt like I had a bigger impact on the user if I could do the user experience. So I was really interested in that. And at the time, there's not a lot of resources on the web, but I began self-teaching, and then gradually over time, became a somewhat competent designer and user experience designer, to the point where eventually people stopped hiring me for back-end coding or coding in general, and more on the product design and design side.
That's kind of the focus of your agency. Do you do projects where you're not doing the coding, you're just doing the sort of UI UX experience, or is it kind of all the way through coding and?
Sure, we're fairly a la carte, we say. So, you know, we can do just the design, we can just do the coding, although that's very rare for us. Most of the time we either just do the design or do the whole thing.
Are all your team members like in an office, or do you have remote workers? How's that sort of look?
Sure, we have a blend. You know, we're based, headquartered in Silicon Valley in San Jose, and about a third of us are co-located in the Bay Area, and the other two-thirds is remote. There's a concentration of our contractors in India, all on the engineering team, web and mobile. But we also have contractors in Europe, mostly Eastern Europe, Russia, Czech Republic, and the Ukraine.
Oh, wow. How do you find those sort of remote workers?
You know, we find them online, and we go through an interview process. We give them a coding challenge, like a very small app. So our interview process has evolved over time. But what we have now is, you know, we have a very small sample app that you have to code, which we'll pay for, and we'll see how they perform. We evaluate them by the code they write, by the ability for them to follow process, you know, check in code into GitHub and stuff, push builds to us, and their ability to communicate. So there's you know, three broad metrics that we judge them by.
Is there a particular app that you use to find workers?
You know, it's all over the place. You know, we've used services like Upwork. We looked at people's GitHub profiles. We've tried TopTal. We don't want to say we go to, you know, we do one thing. You know, since we already have to be creative and hire remote workers, we tend to be pretty creative in trying to find them if they have an online footprint. Yeah, like we've reached out to people on Stack Overflow, like, hey, this is a good answer, and you're obviously an expert in this, you know something about this, I'll reach out to you, and then if you respond, great, you know.
What is sort of the structure of your company like as far as like management and project management and stuff like that?
I would say we're still a pretty small organization, so a lot of times, maybe like maybe a year or two ago, we've definitely had a lot of growing pains because I try to keep as flat a structure as possible. But nowadays, there's more project managers and senior leadership in terms of software development or design. So I have project managers under me. So they manage individual accounts or projects. if a client is fairly big and they have multiple projects, you know, we may have just a single PM who basically worries about that client and has the overall picture of all the various projects. We have senior technical leadership in terms of mobile and web, you know, in terms of setting standards and expectations of all the engineers, as well as, you know, the design counterpart.
So how much is like an average project cost at Impeccable?
Sure. You know, we're fairly a la carte. So if it's only design, you know, it's one thing. You know, design projects can be, you know, we do have a minimum of $10,000. So if you know, being an agency, anything smaller than that is kind of really tough in terms of resources and management and, you know, the overhead, that's not usually worth our time. You know, a typical app spend could be between, on the smaller end, like I said, $10,000 might get you not all the screens of the app, maybe, you know, a few critical screens or enough screens to, you know, use in a deck, you know, a VC presentation or like a user flow for, you know, within an Envision. I think a complete app design end-to-end would be at least $30,000, and that's just for the design. So, and then building the app, let's say for maybe on the low end, $50,000. On the higher end, you know, we've been doing ongoing work with large customers where it's just nonstop. They just have more features and, you know, we're very sprint-based. So we have one client that we've worked with for about 2 years now where I believe we're almost sprint 30. We have two-week sprints. So you can imagine the spend there where, you know, we have several developers on the team and a designer jumping in and out as needed and dedicated PM. So that, you know, kind of is on the higher end of the spend where it's...
If that team isn't working on anything else, then you, basically they have to cover all the salaries.
Exactly. So, and that's just ongoing. That's their, you know, they look to us as their, you know, app development partner. We are essentially their outsourced mobile team.
Well, I want to move on to UI UX, but before I do, what is one of the biggest mistakes you've made so far in launching your agency?
Trying to do too much by myself for too long. I think cash flow was always on top of mind. So, you know, the decision between, oh, do I spend X and bring on somebody to help me free up my time or do it? Or do I try to do it for as long as possible until I can't do it anymore? You know, I would always err on the latter because that was always the cheaper alternative. And I think because you suffer from the curse of knowledge, right, being both technical and on the design side, yeah, I kind of tried to do too much because I could do it. I have peers who own agencies, and it turns out, you know, it's for people who are not technical at all or who are not design-oriented at all, life is a lot easier because the only thing they can do is just get more help, right?
Right.
Whereas I'm like, oh, I can do it myself. I'll just do it. And then that just stacks and stacks and stacks. So I think the biggest mistake that any producer could do is to try to keep doing it themselves for far too long and not realizing they, you know, their time is better spent doing other things. You know, like company strategy, leadership, you know, company direction, winning bigger accounts, for example, and stuff like that.
Do you do any design or coding or anything anymore?
I still involve myself with some design decisions, but I don't live in design tools much anymore. I still do some quick wireframing every now and then. I'll poke in and kind of give my opinion about certain projects, you know, kind of the design of certain projects, but not really in the day-to-day. Coding-wise, I've been known to help junior developers kind of debug every now and then, but not really coding any real features anymore.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense with a agency your size. Lots of management to do.
Yeah. For better or for worse. Yeah.
So as far as UI UX, can you briefly explain what UI and UX are? Just because I know that everyone kind of probably has a slightly different definition.
Sure, yeah, and there's different types of agencies as well, like creative agencies, branding agencies, so you may not always, you know, if you don't do this type of work, you may not know what it is. So UI stands for user interface, UX stands for user experience, so they're very related, but they're not the same thing. So user experience design, I would say, is a design of how things are put together, you know, the architecture of something. So if I had to put it in sort of more concrete terms, the user experience is similar to like the blueprints of a house. You know, we're concerned with how things are laid out, what the things are. You know, so if a company comes up to us with an app idea or requirements for an app, the UX will involve figuring out, you know, how do those requirements translate into components, how many screens, how those screens are organized. So say you have, you know, 100 features, you know, how would you organize those 100 features, turn those 100 features into components? User interface design would be the visual, you know, the pretty pixels. Mm-hmm. You know, if it were the analogy of a house, it would be like the interior design, right? You know, what color the walls are, that to me is more the user interface.
What is the process in which you are sort of selling your services or describing these services for a client? You know, developing an app can be awfully complex, and I'm sure that people are coming to you who don't know exactly what they want. How do you sort of outline those deliverables? Does it take a lot of upfront work even before, like, they sign on a contract to sort of, like, outline everything?
Sure. We typically go through a requirements gathering phase. I know certain agencies will charge for that, you know, to do, like, a huge discovery. We may or may not do that depending on how detailed the requirements already are. In terms of explaining UI and UX, fortunately, where we are in the industry, a lot of people are somewhat familiar, who come to us are already familiar with those terms, and they kind of know what it means. But they have a sense that what UI and UX are, and that's what they're looking for, and that's why they're coming to us to fix. In terms of the process, we typically will ask the client for things like, what are the requirements? Do you have an existing product? What are you looking to accomplish with, you know, when people want a new UX or UI revamp, like, what is the goal? So, you know, who are the users? Do you have existing metrics or data based on, you know, if you do have goals, whether it's improving onboarding, so like, well, what's wrong with the onboarding right now? What is the conversion rate? You know, what are you trying to, where do you think they're getting stuck? And what are they saying where they're getting stuck? Where do you see the drop-off? Stuff like that. Once we have enough, we typically will put together a proposal. And, you know, in terms of our deliverables, once we start engaging, you know, the deliverables will include maybe personas, wireframes, mood board. We'll typically do a lot of research in terms of competitor apps and, like, sort of their best practices and what the competitors are doing well, what recurring design patterns come up over and over within this industry, you know, and if that's a good pattern, if it's convention or if it's, or can we improve on it, we'll do wireframes. We typically put that in Envision, which is a prototyping tool. We try to get our customers to give their feedback through Envision. Once the wireframes are approved, we will try to take those to visual design. We may do several visual design explorations or mock-ups.
And you have designers in-house that do the design work?
Yeah, most of the designers are in-house.
How would you say that mobile has changed UI UX?
Fortunately, mobile has been around for a while. That is, you know, new designers getting into this probably will most likely focus on maybe mobile first rather than web. That said, a lot of our work is still web application design. There's still plenty of that. But mobile in general has forced people to focus and simplify. Mobile interfaces are smaller than desktop interfaces, so to design on mobile is to really focus. You know, you can pretty much only get very few things, maybe one, two, or three things in a mobile screen, you know, in terms of goals. And that has forced people to really hone down. And for startups, this is great because people tend to have a tendency to try to cram in, you know, and not really do an MVP or minimum viable product. But by doing a mobile first approach, you really are forced to focus because there's not that much real estate. And the small screen, the narrow screen, is essentially a forcing function to get you to focus on solving the problem.
Yeah, in a way, it seems like it's almost brought UI UX to the forefront because it's so important on mobile.
Exactly, yeah. And in terms of visual design, over the years, we've seen kind of Apple leading the design charge in terms of how the design aesthetics of app design in mobile, from beginning from skeuomorphism, which is basically having design elements, visual elements, look like real physical counterparts in real life. So like if you have a button in UI, you know, say like 5 years ago or 7 years ago, a button kind of looked like a physical button with drop shadows and, you know, slight gradients and texture.
Right. It's like how the iTunes logo used to be an actual CD.
Right, right. And nowadays, everything is kind of flat. You know, colors are flat, shapes are very simple. So in that sense, like visual design nowadays look a lot more like wireframes. There's sometimes not that much distinguishing other than color. So in that sense, it's kind of been simplified in terms of visual design. But I would say, you know, user experience has deepened as we explore deeper and deeper into mobile.
I know that conventions are really important to UI UX design. I know that's something that we, when we design websites, is very important to us, is creating conventions and using conventions that already exist. Can you talk about why conventions are so important in UI UX design?
I would say conventions are important everywhere and just as important in UI UX design. You know, when you get into a car, in a US car, the convention is, you know, the driver seat is in the front and that the driver seat is on the left and you can expect a steering wheel in front of you. And, you know, when you brake, and then you can get into, if you know how to drive a car, you can pretty much get into any US car. You know, if you drive automatic, you feel confident that any car, as long as they follow convention, you feel confident in using it. There's no training involved, right? When things, you know, imagine if a car designer broke convention and decided to put the driver's seat in the back right seat instead of the front left seat. If they break convention, then you don't know what to do. So same thing with mobile design. You know, there are certain expectations. For example, you know, a login screen typically will have, you know, the username or email field and the password, then the sign in or login button. That's pretty much a convention. So if you even switch password and email, I think you'll get a lot of people who'll just by default, without even thinking, you know, muscle memory, they'll put the email or username first and then the password. So if you try switching that, you'll just get a lot of failed sign-ins.
This is a very good description and good metaphors for that. When can you break a convention?
I think you can break a convention when you have a very good reason to do so. When something is just taken, hasn't been questioned for so long, but time has moved on and things are no longer applicable, I think then that's when you can break convention. For example, so a good convention not to break, for example, is the back button. The back button is typically on the top left. And people, you know, that's like muscle memory. If you're going to drill down into mobile pages and you want to go back, typically both Android and iOS will have a back button on the top left. Occasionally you'll see it on the bottom left, maybe in browser apps or something. But if you were to just try to put that on the bottom right, you'll see that people will be really confused. They won't know how to get back because they don't know to look there. Let's say a convention that is good to break is something that maybe is so antiquated that it just no longer applies to the new generation. For example, like the save button. The save button will be sometimes the icon of a floppy disk. Well, you know, I've hired people, young designers, who have never seen a floppy disk. So I think, you know, an app that still uses a floppy disk to symbolize save may or may not resonate with the younger generation, right? And that to me is when it's okay to break convention. People still use pen and pencil, so creating or write, you know, the icon for creating or writing something can still be a pen, right, or a pencil. it's interesting, like in messaging services, the phone call icon is still the old phone shape, you know, from when people had a rotary phone. Right. And most people don't have those phones anymore, right? They have cell phones that look pretty rectangular and flat, but that is still the convention. In 30 years, I'd be surprised that if that was still around, you know, maybe it's time to break that.
Are there reasons sometimes where something's not antiquated, but you sort of make a decision to sort of purposely break a convention, if you can think of any examples like that?
I can't think of any right now, but typically, you know, within an industry, you'll find that things are done a certain way because they're done a certain way. Right. And when we come in to look at this problem with a fresh set of eyes, not knowing anything about the industry, sometimes we challenge those conventions like, oh, wow, that's really a lot of steps. Or, you know, like if this is how you do it, here's what we see in other industries to accomplish a similar task, maybe not the same task. But hey, here's a set of procedures that maps really well to what you guys are trying to do, and here's how they look at it. Here's how the design patterns for it. You know, would you be open to trying this design pattern, and applying this convention to your older convention? So we kind of try to challenge people who come to us. So for example, we work with in the fashion industry, and we were trying to improve a UX of something. You know, and the client had said, well, this is how we do it. This is how people have always done it. You know, they don't think like that. And we're trying to see, well, is this something that, you know, we can ever win on if we try to change how people do this? By, you know, we may end up simplifying it, we propose it, but if this is not how people in the industry think about it, do you think we could, you know, accept it? Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, it's something that we have to explore and test as user experience designers, but we definitely owe it to clients to propose it if there's a better way.
One convention that everybody's probably, or at least everybody who works in web is probably familiar with, is the hamburger menu. It's those three horizontal lines that usually represent a menu. Why do you think the hamburger menu is used so often?
Yeah, actually, I think the hamburger menu was introduced in mobile first, and it is used fairly often. It's a shortcut. You know, I think it's a design shortcut. It's design laziness in a way. So analytics from our own apps and client apps tells us that sidebar menus are indeed less engaging. There's actually been other researchers who've done this, design researchers. There's a couple reasons for this. A lot of people don't know what those three lines mean. You know, A/B testing experiments have revealed that statistically significant amount of users don't have a clue what those three lines mean. So actually, it's clearer to just have it say menu. If you just had the text that said menu, it's actually more apparent what it is without having to explain what three lines mean. And if they don't know what it is, they just don't click it. The other thing is when you shove or navigation elements in within those three lines, they disappear in terms of like it's out of sight, out of mind. If the desired behavior is not for users to navigate those and then you just want to shove things away, a hamburger menu is fine. When I say it's design laziness, it's when designers can't figure out where to shove something. Oh, let's just shove it in the menu. You know, it's the same way as like, oh, let's just put it in the settings, right? Like I can't figure out how to put this or where to, in terms of how to organize this information, I'm just going to shove it in the menu. And then because it's out of sight, out of mind, those menu items, it's harder for people when things are not there to keep it in top of mind. You know, this is why user interfaces, graphical user interfaces, are superior to command line interfaces for the average person. Command line interfaces requires users to recall commands, right? For the terminal, if you don't know the commands, a command line interface is fairly useless. But with a graphical user interface, that only requires visual recognition. So something is visual recognition requires much less cognitive load, and for that, you know, it's more useful. So tab bars have more opportunities because everything is there. You see the tabs. And there's more opportunities for engagement. And what do I mean by that? So like, let's just take, you know, any social app where there's tabs at the bottom. You know, you may have a tab that says notifications, direct messages, and something else. And there's opportunities to show badges within those, right? Like if you just shove it in a menu and you only have, that hamburger menu now really only has one badge that you can have, right? At the bottom, you could potentially have a badge for new notifications, a tab for a badge for new messages. You know, you can drive user behavior. When I see a new message, I can click, you know, I can click on that. But if it's just a generic badge for the member hamburger menu, then I don't know what that is.
That makes sense. So it sounds like you probably try to avoid hamburger menus.
I do. Yeah, I try to avoid it a lot. Sometimes it's just not unavoidable because there's just too many things that people want to shove in. So like convention, Apple interface guidelines recommends that you have no more than so 5 navigation items. And if it's the case where there's really more than 5 navigation, main navigation, top level navigation items, then you have to introduce something like a hamburger menu.
Right. So do you find it hard to hire UI UX designers? I mean, you can't really go to school for UI UX yet, can you?
Oh, well, you know, there are programs, you know, there's HCI programs. There are UI UX classes now offered, you know, as part of design class. So there are, and people do graduate with UI UX skills. But in terms of hiring, for me, you know, having designed for so long, it's not hard for me to hire one. You know, being able to look at portfolio is, and having them talk through the portfolio is very easy, I guess, to determine whether you're, you know, a competent UI UX designer. For me, because I'm more kind of in the web world, in mobile, you know, my engineering background, it's a little harder for me to evaluate, say, mobile development talent. I need to have, you know, kind of more processes around hiring, you know, a mobile engineer.
Would you say a UX designer needs to have more experience sort of in analytics and data?
I think there's a lot of specialization even within the UX community now and the UX career. So there's pure UX designers who live in wireframing and, you know, they don't even touch UI. And you can be a perfectly good UX designer, you know, if you understand that. There's UX researchers who don't even do much wireframing, and they spend all their time, you know, interviewing and observing and understanding users. So even within that field, there's a lot of specialization going on right now. For us, being a small company, we tend to hire people who can do UI design as well as do the hardcore UX skills, just because, you know, we don't have enough work to be able to say, hey, if all you want to do is wireframe, we can keep you occupied. That's not the case for us. And to the point of hiring, you know, going to school for UX, actually, I don't feel like school is necessary, not just for UI UX, but for coding. Many of the designers we've hired in the past don't even have design backgrounds, myself included. You know, we have an architect who's turned, you know, like an actual architect, not UX architect, wanted to explore a career in UX design, and he had a portfolio, and, you know, he started interning with us. We had a linguistics major. We have an army vet who have all kind of embraced and self-taught and learned the skills enough to be really good, you know, not just competent, but really good UX designers.
How do you know that when you look at a website or an app, how do you know that it has good or bad UI UX?
Well, UI is pretty easy to judge. You know, the I think you know, people may not know how to articulate, even customers may not know how to articulate what is good or bad, but they know bad or good UI when they see it, right? You know, that's just how things are put together. Things could look dated, things could look very sloppy, things don't make sense. In terms of UX, it's a little bit harder, and that's why typically they can't quite figure out why their UX is bad. They come to us. But typically good UX, you know, products feel intuitive. They don't require much onboarding. They don't require much explanation. So if you have an interface where somebody has to stand over your shoulder and kind of navigate you and direct you, that's probably could be improved. Good UX could be anticipatory. So a good example of that is Gmail's suggest feature. So let's say you start typing an email and you address it to someone. Gmail, you know, if you typically include other people in that email, it'll suggest, hey, do you want to include this person and this person? And all you have to do is click instead of having to type. You know, that's anticipatory UX that is quite nice, because it's saving you steps. You know, like imagine all those keystrokes. If an email address is, say, 20 characters long, it saved you that many steps by just with a click. Bad UX feels frustrating. It feels like there's no feedback oftentimes. So, for example, like if you submit something and there's no feedback of that the post went or it failed, and you have no idea, you just, you know, bad UX causes anxiety. Bad UX typically allows users to easily make mistakes. So if a field requires numbers, but you can enter text, it allows users to make mistakes. If a field requires whole numbers, but it lets you enter in decimal points, you know, that's bad UX because you're allowing people to unnecessarily make mistakes.
That's interesting. I never really thought of UX that way, as keeping people from making mistakes. That's kind of a nice way of thinking about that aspect.
Yeah, that's just one aspect, but yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. This is really interesting. I love diving into UX. I realize we just sort of scratched the surface, but do you actually work with other agencies? Like if someone was looking for UX design for a project that they're going to build or anything like that?
Yeah, we've actually partnered in the last couple of years. We've actually partnered with some firms. Typically, these could be, they are more typically pure software engineering firms that don't specialize in UX, and mm-hmm. they've typically only taken on the role of just building software. So in the last couple of years, bigger firms have approached us because they want to, one, be able to differentiate. Two, you know, UI and UX are coming to the forefront, and customers are demanding that, and they're not able to offer that, and they don't have the expertise to staff that, and because that's not what they do, they can't just spin up a UX team because they don't know good from bad UX and designers. So they partner with us because we have the reputation.
That's cool. I always ask my guests for three takeaways. In your case, you know, this would be advice you might pass on to other agency entrepreneurs in regards to UI UX. What do you have for me?
Sure. It's hard for me to give UX advice because it's like maybe a lot of it is just kind of taken for granted for me. But in building my own agency, I do have a lot of advice. I would say the number one thing, you know, is cash flow, right? Making sure that you have enough business coming in. And one of the skills that has really helped me with getting business is follow-ups. When people say no, it doesn't mean no, but it maybe sometimes means not now, right? They don't need you just yet, or maybe they've used up their budget for the quarter, you know, for whatever it is, right? Like maybe the timing is not right. So by following up with people and kind of pinging them and keeping them top of mind, when they do need you, they'll think of you. So following up. And also, like, if they want to work with you, some clients, they're their own worst enemy in the sense that if they don't have the follow-up skills to follow up with you and you don't follow up with them, you just end up losing the relationship because they think you're not interested when, in fact, maybe you are. So following up with customers, you know, especially when you want something from them, meaning, you know, you can't produce, say, a quote because you need their documentation, you need requirements. Requirements typically require the client to do the work, and people don't want to do the work. That's why they're hiring you. So they'll drag their feet on producing requirements or getting the files to you, or like say the brand assets or whatever it is that you need from them. So follow up is a very important skill. From a business perspective, knowing your numbers. I would say very early on in the business when I was just so in the weeds of designing and coding, you know, my level of sophistication with regards to the business accounting was, as long as there was more money coming in than money leaving, I was okay. But now, you know, we track profitability on a per project basis. You know, we know which contractors and employees, like how much they produce and contribute to the bottom line, you know, which accounts make how much and which customers owe us the most money, like knowing your numbers and you know, being able to predict them in terms of understanding the pipeline of customers that's important for your business. Like, if you can't know that how much business you'll be doing and how much profit you'll be making and how much you'll be netting, because at some point you'll get more work than you can prioritize, and you'll be forced to turn down work. So you'll have to make some tough decisions. So you'll need to know, you know, you may have a big account, but if it's not really profitable, is it in your best interest to keep that? So you may want to keep, you know, a couple, you may want to turn that one down and do, you know, maybe a few more of the mid-sized projects that are way more profitable, right? Because at the end of the day, it's not really just about the pure numbers of cash, but it's the net profit, right? What do you keep at the end of the day? And then the third advice I would say is to manage and grow relationships and or market. I'm not a very good marketer, and I would say in the last 4 years, most of the work has been come through just our reputation or word of mouth. You know, we do a good job for one client, and another client, you know, ask for a referral because they're looking for someone, and they usually come through a referral. We try to grow accounts, meaning if say we're in a big organization and we typically will start to work with only one group, but if we do a good job for that group, you know, trying to grow within that organization and, you know, leapfrog to other groups and see if you can lend a hand and grow that as a, you know, the client in terms of having multiple groups work with you. So managing and growing relationships, you know, can, again, because, you know, when you're in the weeds just working on the projects, you neglect these sort of things, you know, that are important to the business. And marketing as well. Like, I've put off marketing for so long. This year we've dedicated marketing. Like, I would say, I mean, in the first 3 years of the company's life, we spent, you know, effectively $0 on marketing. And now we're marketing this year, and you know, we're finally, after like Q3, we're finally seeing some of the fruits of that marketing.
That's good. Good advice. And yeah, I know those struggles all too well at Murmur Creative. Putting those resources into management and business strategy and marketing is difficult when you get your head buried in client work so much.
Yeah. And then, you know, every agency, I think a lot of agencies suffer from, you know, their website is so neglected, right? Our website is at least over a year old, right? Just because it's the cobbler's dilemma, right? Like the shoes, you have time for everybody's shoes except your own.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Peck. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
You've been listening to the Creative Agency Podcast with your host, Chris Bolton. When he's not podcasting or being a dad, he's the Digital Strategy Director at Murmur Creative in Portland, Oregon. Be sure to visit us online at creativeagencypodcast.com.